Let us go back and look at where we've come from. First of all, the overriding statement of this entire section that we're dealing with in the book of Ephesians, putting it in its context, stop walking as the Gentiles walk. If there's anything that's a constant reminder to us, it's just quit living like the world. Quit acting like the Gentiles live. Quit yoking ourselves up together with unbelievers. So we see, first of all, then, there's something we should always do, and that's preserve unity. That is a mandate of God, verses 1 to 16. And the issue is not primarily about spiritual gifts. It's about the unity of the church and the use of those gifted people that God has given to perpetuate and to cause the perseverance of unity to exist. Something we should never do, chapter 5, verse 3 and following. And there should not be, again, we're back to this immoral acts. Don't even discuss it. Let the words not even be mentioned with you. No coarse jesting, no anything of that nature. It should never be. This is not something we progressively deal with. It's something that we must decisively put away from our life if, in fact, we truly are children of God. In between these two sections, we find some things we should progressively do. And in this context, we talk about forsaking the way of the Gentiles, and then let's just walk through that for a bit and look at some of these areas together, and we'll put some all of this back on. This, therefore, I say, and again, I remind you, I say in line one, I bear witness in line two, emphasizing the crucial point that is yet to be made. And the crucial point is twice stated, and then within the Lord is the end of that saying that we no longer walk as the Gentiles walk. And again, reminding you that if the no longer is in there, suggesting that there is a tendency for us to do this. And we need to stop any longer walking like the Gentiles walk. It is, in fact, the great statement of Peter, it's enough. Go with me just there for a moment. 1 Peter chapter 4. An impressive statement by Peter with regard to this very, very issue. And it is repeated by so many authors. But notice, therefore, since Christ, verse 1 of chapter 4, has suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves with the same purpose, because he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, so as to live the rest of the time in the flesh, no longer for the lusts of the men, but for the will of God. And then this is the interesting statement, verse 3, for the time, 1 Peter 4:3, for the time already past is sufficient for you to have carried out the desires of the Gentiles. You know what? We've done it long enough. And so Peter says, now that you've become a child of God, you live that way long enough, it's time to quit it. So no longer walking as the Gentiles walk. And then as we continue this, we sense how this was, the futility of all of this, because even the foolishness of walking this way is given to us, because in the futility of their mind. And the result of this, their understanding is darkened because of the darkness of their mind. They are estranged, and we have this. Let's just keep moving down here. They're estranged. We need to finish the sentence because it doesn't do it there. We're estranged from the life that comes from God because of their ignorance which is in them and because of the insensitivity of their hearts. And so the two things that do it, the ignorance of man, the insensitivity of man, because the Spirit of God is not there transforming their life. And now you notice who, having become incensed themselves, gave themselves over to sensuality unto the working of all uncleanness. And again, this uncleanness is in the greed or covetousness. And what causes this uncleanness to be is the greed or covetousness. And again, it is true as you look later on where he talks about immorality and covetousness. And covetousness, of course, is that root sin. So now what we're going to do. We have not thus learned Christ. This is how we learned him, if indeed we have heard. And in him you were taught just as truth is in Jesus. This isn't the way we learned to live when we came to faith in Christ. Therefore, because of this, this is what we're to do. This, therefore, I say, in light of the fact that we're not to walk as the Gentiles and we didn't learn Christ this way, therefore, this I say, and we're back to this I say again, that you put aside, according to the former manner of life, the old man who is being corrupted according to the lusts of deceit. And again, it's the deceit that drives the lust. It is that sense that somehow it is more fun, there can be peace, the sense that somehow, you know, I can find a greater life of joy down here if I leave you and marry somebody else, as some people do. That is not what it is. That is lust of deceit. Deceitfulness is always the root of these kinds of things. But now notice, and I want to come back to this sheet again in just a little while, because it's so crucial for us, and I'll show you in a while. I will leave this aside, Rodney, remembering where I put it. Let me take you past this. If I'm to put off the old man, what I'm supposed to be doing is putting on the new man, which is according to God, not according to the Gentiles, according to the lust, but according to God, is created in righteousness and holiness of the truth. It is this truth at the bottom, and truth is such a major issue. It's the truth that is the producer of the righteousness. It's truth that's the producer of the holiness. And by the way, this evening we will see the veracity of this. It is the truth of the Word of God that creates the righteousness and holiness within us, and this is according to God, not according to man. And the issue is, you put off, you put on. And this is what we do. Now, the way this happens, though, is in the middle, because the put off and put on are acts that we do, decisive acts, but this is the constant thing that has happened, the constant renewing of the spirit of the mind. It is the constant renewing of our minds that causes us to live this way. Now, in this regard, the very first thing we came to, and we've been dealing with for several weeks, is the matter of dishonesty. When he now begins to apply this truth, and he brings it down specifically, he says, now let me apply this, okay? This is the general principle, this is the application. What I want you to see here is very significant, and it is good for you to learn this word. It is a good word for you to carry with you, because it is all over the place. It is this word right here. See this word right here. Just let me give it to you, this one. Now, let me do the English transliteration part. It is these three letters right here. It looks like the, but it's the. Or te, actually, but that's all right, it doesn't matter. This is to put or place. That's what the word means, is to put or place. This is it right here, these two letters right here, see? Then there is this part, from, away from. It is the preposition away from. So it is putting away from. Okay? Now he is speaking to us. We are the subjects of this, and therefore there is this, which we call the nominative case, or in English, the subject of the sentence. So this is the subject, and we are it. And we are to put away. And then this little part here, so significant, because what we call it, the middle voice. Now let me tell you what this is, because it's in one sense, well, I'll show you. Okay, let me tell you what the middle voice is. The active, if in English we do it, the active, the subject does the action. The man hit the ball. Okay? That's active, all right? Yes? Now listen to this. The man was hit by the ball. Now that's what? That's passive. He didn't do it. It was done to him, right? Ah, but now there's in between that in Greek. The man himself hit the ball. In other words, the man himself and nobody else. Are you with me? Now, that's what this is. This is not the man did it. This isn't the man had it done to him. This is the man himself did this. Okay, now, how are you with me? Just watch this, okay? Therefore, this is this. You, right here, you, yourselves, place away from yourselves. Now, why this is significant, because this is in the matter of honesty and dishonesty, right? But just look at this word, okay? Let me take you back to the sheet we just had up here, and I will overlay it, however I can do this. See this right here? Aha! This is the same word again. See this? See this? Put from yourself. And this is a different form, but it's also a middle voice. This I say, therefore, that you yourselves place away from yourselves. Now, I will belabor this, because I have to belabor this. Walk with me. Again, I'll take you back to where we were in 1 Peter this morning. Go with me there, first of all. And then when we get to 1 Peter, we'll walk back to James. I want to show you, it doesn't matter whether it's Paul or Peter or James. They all say the same thing. So I'm in 1 Peter chapter 2. And I'm in verse 1, the passage you know so very well. Therefore, 1 Peter 2:1, putting aside from yourself. Now, what the word is, by the way, let me talk to you about this. It is the same form exactly as this one right here, this one that I've scribbled all up, see? That's exactly the same form right here. You yourselves place away from yourselves. In other words, look in 1 Peter 2. Look at this. 1 Peter 1, he says in verse 22, since you have an obedience to the truth. And here's truth again. You have an obedience to the truth, purified your souls for sincere love of the brethren. Here's the command, fervently love one another from the heart. Now he says, and you can skip the rest for a while down to chapter 2, verse 1, because that's where it goes. Therefore, because of this, verse 1 of chapter 2, you yourselves putting aside from yourself all malice, all guile, all kinds of hypocrisy, all kinds of envy, and all slander. Now, all of those things, and malice is the first one, and it covers all the others, these are the things that keep us from loving. And what he's saying in this is, if I command you to love, chapter 1, verse 22, and if you do not put away the things that keep you from loving, in chapter 2, verse 1, you cannot thirst, chapter 2, verse 2. It can't happen. Can't happen. Let me tell you something. If there's anybody today as a child of God who is not putting away malice and guile, deceit, whatever, envy, and hypocrisy, they cannot thirst. Okay? And you yourselves must place away from yourself these things. It isn't, God, please take the malice out of my heart. No, God says, you take it out of there. See? It's important. Now, walk back with me to James. James, the book just before this, chapter 1. Same form exactly. Exactly the same form. They all use the same word. Look at this. I'm in chapter 1. It's that verse that tells us about anger. Start in verse 19. This you know, my beloved brethren, let everyone be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger. For the anger of man does not achieve the righteousness of God. Therefore, here it is, putting aside all filthiness. And then, if you will, it says all that remains of wickedness. But you know, this is one of my favorite phrases from King James. Putting aside all superfluity of naughtiness. Do you know what the word is? The same word again. Exactly the same form, everything, see? The point of all of this is that we ourselves must do it, okay? This business of, pray for me, brother, because I'm trying to get rid of anger. God says, hold it. Got to pray for you because you're being disobedient to God and not dealing with the issues, right? Are we there? It is amazing how this verb keeps coming up over and over and over again, and how every time it is the aorist and every time it's the middle, because what it is, it's an action you do, and it's an action you yourself do. We would talk about this in a while when we get back to chapter 5, but if people come, I can't. One fellow in the ministry. Not that many years ago, he comes and says, I've got a problem with pornography. I just can't deal with this thing because where I'm living, they've got this stuff on TV. I say, don't have to watch it. You know, it's amazing stuff these days. You know, there's all this stuff on TV. You know what? You've got a finger and you've got the ability to push the button off, you see. I mean, look at all the bad stuff they put on TV. You don't have to watch what they put on TV. I mean, what is this? The government clean up the stuff. Listen, how about you cleaning up the stuff? You don't have to go to the movie. You don't have to watch it on TV. You don't even have to own one. Do you understand this? Now, I happen to own one. John Piper, 27 years in ministry, he says, never owned one. And he says, I'm not out of it at all. He says, I'm relevant enough. And he says, I don't have a TV, never owned one. But the point of it all is, you see, you yourselves do this. You say to this guy, you know what, you deal with this problem. We come now, though, to tonight. It is the next section in this thing, and here it is. The first thing is you replace dishonesty with honesty, okay? The second one, this, by the way, is all a part of this taking off the old self and putting on the new one, okay? And this is what we do, and this is the renewing of the mind. And this is the second thing, we be angry and do not sin. The sun, let it not go down upon the wrath of you. Do not give place to the devil. Now, I want to deal with this evening because this is one of those things where we read this thing and we draw all kinds of conclusions in a hurry. Now, it is very fascinating, by the way. Just let me deal with this section first just for a few moments, because there are a bunch of views on this, because it is pretty clear. I don't care whether it's English, Greek, or whatever you do. It's pretty clear. But listen to the way people have to do this. There are five different views on this. I don't want you to take them down, but listen to this. People are trying to get around this command because it bothers them, see? Now, what we're going to do, and it's going to take us a couple weeks to do this, we're going to process this, and we're going to just walk slowly through here, because we want to deal with some issues here in this passage. But I'm going to, first of all, start with some of these views, and then I want to take you back and bring you to some thoughts at the end of this section, then bring us back to here again. Okay, first of all, listen to some of these views. The first, and these are pretty good people. The first one they translate, if you are angry, do not sin. Now, that doesn't look like if to me. I don't care whether it's English or Greek, doesn't look like if to me. But they can't handle the fact that God would tell us be angry. This bothers them, see? And so we immediately, I'm just telling you, let's just start with this and say, understand, this, listen. Well, I'll do this one just as easier for me to get out. It'll work. This is it, right? This is a very interesting thing because, by the way, you analyze words. There is a word in James that talks about God having a passionate anger against, okay, or feelings, harsh feelings against. And wherever the word is used, it's used in a very harsh sense. And when you read people's analysis of the passage, they say, well, you know what? This, if it's of God, it can't mean the same thing it means everywhere else, because God can't feel that way. If God wants to feel that way, God can feel that way, right? Yes? You see, the issue is you don't tell God what God cannot do. So we sit down and say, for us, we read this, I have a problem. I can't handle this, be angry. Because anger is wrong. Anger is not always wrong. Well, these guys would think maybe this, so they translate, if you're angry, do not sin. Listen to the next one. Be angry if it must be so, only do not sin. Well, okay, that may work, but there, if it must be so isn't in there, but that's anyhow, they try that. Let's try another one. Are you angry? They put the first one, and some of you know, in fact, Ken called me a while back, he says, was there punctuation in the original? No. So therefore, you could have a question mark here. Are you angry? Then don't sin. Okay, now you could. But you know, it's pretty simple just to read it like it is, right? Be angry. But at the same time, do not be sinning. That's simply what it says. And it's pretty simple. Back to this business. Bring me your 13-year-old. Let her read it or him read it. Let them tell us what they think it says. And I'm willing to, because it sounds pretty simple to me. And let's go on. So with this in mind, I want to then go somewhere and lay a foundation for you just for a while. Because it's very, very important. The issue. And really, if there is an issue here, it is this part. I take you down, and I'm going to put another sheet on here because I want to take you down to verse 31. And where I want to pick up in verse 31 is just one line. We'll come back to verse 31 before we're through with this and even get back to verse 26. Now look at this statement here as it comes to verse 31, right? All, look, it starts with the word all bitterness and all wrath. Oh, I just went this right. And all anger, that's okay, we did it. And all clamor, that word all at the beginning is there first and it goes, it tells all about all of them. All bitterness, not most bitterness, all wrath, all anger, all clamor, all blasphemy. Let it be put away from you. Now it is this last statement. Let it be put away with you from you with all malice. This word malice down here at the very end, you see, in the end of verse 31. And again, the nice thing is the next verse, but become unto one another kind and good hearted, see? But what you see, it is that statement, the last three words of verse 31 that you see there, that sun passe kakia, with all malice. Now, that is somewhat covering all of this because that's the one that Peter says. See, therefore, having put away from yourself all malice, and then all guile and hypocrisies and envies and evil speaking. See, the guile, the hypocrisies, the envies, the evil speaking are all manifestations of malice. Malice is the issue. The source of this, the sinfulness of anger, has to do with the attitude that causes the anger, or the motivation for the anger, see. We'll come back to this in a while. But I want to lay some groundwork because I think it's very important to lay the groundwork just generally with regard to this. So walk with me in this because there is a sense in which anger is a very good thing, but there is a sense in which anger should not be. So let's deal with that and come back to this again, and we'll leave this for a while. But understand, the bottom line issue is the malice that has to go. And again, yeah, I take you back to 1 Peter or whatever, you yourself must put away from yourself these things. Now, let us go back to the overall outline of this section. Let us talk about this. And I want to address this before we come back and address the passage we're in. First of all, just to make the statement that we are, and this I will get by walking elsewhere for a while and then coming back here, because there's no doubt. I mean, I could just stick with this verse and it'd be very simple to do. But we are not to express anger that does not grow out of love for God or love for others. I would say if there is a rule in here, that's the rule. There is anger that's right, and we'll talk about that. In fact, let's look at this together, because it's very, very, very important in here. The love of God and the love of Christ become the pattern for the believer. And more we find that people are making the statement either verbally or a statement of doctrine or practically, in that way the situation, the overriding attribute of God is love. But just wait. Is the overriding attribute of God love? See, that is what has got us into a lot of trouble. We have, and there's a strong feeling among people, whether they verbalize it or not, that this is the greatest attribute of God. Can you put one attribute over another? Are they not equally the attributes of God? But if there is an attribute that stands, that governs all attributes, if anything, would be the holiness of God. Whatever God does to do out of holiness. It is amazing because even as someone was talking about, people have problems. You look at the Old Testament, New Testament. Somebody was talking the other day about people who are not believers and they read the Old Testament and they find this angry God in the Old Testament. He's not so angry in the New Testament, and they seem to find a different God, but he's the same God. See, the God of Calvary, or let's put it the other way, the God of Sinai is the God of Calvary. And if he weren't the God of Calvary, then there wouldn't have been Calvary. See, the whole point of it is God's holiness, right? And God's justice had to be dealt with on the cross. It just had to be. We've been in 1 Peter, and then the issue is the matter of the holiness of God. Be holy, for I am holy. And even if you address as Father the one who impartially judges according to each man's work, chapter 1, verse 17, in fear the time of your sojourning past. We have a hard time with the fear of God. We do. As believers, we have a terrible time with the fear of God. I've had people say to me, people you know and care for and love, and they just say, I can't handle this fear of God business. I don't think that's what it is. It's not what drives me. I pray for it to drive me more than it's ever driven me before. The holiness of God. And thereby, from the holiness of God, the fear of God. So, as we address this issue, you come to this thing and you see, we talk about the love of God, and somehow we respond to this kind of thing, and I hear sometimes on these talk things where people are responding and they're hearing some people talk about different things. Well, Jesus wouldn't have done that. And these are not believers, but they've created a Jesus of their own that can't be this way. And so therefore, because of this, I would say there are two areas in which we find this. the fact that we function this way, it has caught us into a trap in the church, certainly. One is in the area of church discipline. People have a terrible time with church discipline. They just do. How can you treat someone that way? That is not very loving. You see, it catches us there because, you see, the issue is, by the way, it is very loving in reality. It is unbelievably loving. And that great statement, one of the passages rarely gone to, by the way, but is the only passage that explicitly discusses the whole issue of church discipline, is 2 Thessalonians 3, and it's fascinating. It says, do not treat them as an enemy, but treat them as a brother. You know what? Be firm. But understand, they're not enemies. I think for some, there's that sense, boy, I can't treat them this way unless somehow I create this kind of a feeling. No, you can't do that. It must be love, and that love must be firm. Because not because you think this is the right thing to do, but because the holiness of God demands it, see. Another one, certainly another area in which this does, is our reaction to the world. Because we hear the name of God being defamed, and we'll talk about this in a while. We hear the name of God being defamed, and it doesn't. Well, maybe it bothers you. Somehow, let me put it this way: it becomes easy for us sometimes to become somewhat callous, or more callous than maybe we should be or used to be. If you listen enough to the defamation of the name of God, the beginning it may bother you, but you hear it so much that maybe we just become grounded in this, and somehow we need to deal with this. God, according to the book of 1 Peter, God is a holy God, God is a just God, and the great truth of this is that God has made provision for our salvation, and therefore dealing with this issue. But let me take you down, just to deal with this for a while. Anger that grows out of a love for God. Now, if in fact we're going to have the God of the Bible, and I'll tell you where I say to you, it is a part of the process of my own soul, trying to let Jesus become the pattern for my life and understanding that Jesus in many ways is not, because I fight it. Walk with me. Let us go to Matthew. Just walk with me for a while. Matthew 21. We just read some of these verses that give us a background to where we are and help us to understand the statement. It is in the context of Scripture as a whole. So Matthew 21 and verse 13. And Jesus, and we start with this, in verse 12, we'll start with that. Jesus entered the temple, Matthew 21, and cast out all those who were buying and selling in the temple. This is his second time, right? He did it at the beginning of his ministry. John tells us he does it at the end of his ministry. Overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who were selling doves. And he said to them, it is written, my house shall be called a house of prayer, and you are making it a robber's den. And it just wait. What drove him was what? That sense of the holiness of God, and that sense, not, you know, it bothers me to see you. No, that's not what the issue was. Not, it bothers me to see you. No, you know what you're doing? You're taking my Father's house, which is a house of prayer, and you're making it a house of merchandise. And that made him angry. And he cast them out of the temple. Go with me back, if you will. Let's leave this one now for a while. Go with me back to Nehemiah. Let's see before Ezra and Nehemiah, Esther, Job, Psalms, Proverbs. Okay, you know where that is. Okay, so let's go to Ezra and Nehemiah. And this is great stuff here. I mean, you just start doing this in the church, and boy, I'll tell you what, we'd have lawsuits. But anyhow, chapter 13. We'll get to all of it, but notice this, okay? Nehemiah chapter 13. Now, let us start, actually. I want to start with verse 11, okay? So I reprimanded the officials and said, why is the house of God forsaken. Go down with me, if you will, to verse 17. And he says, "Then I reprimanded the nobles of Judah and said to them, 'What is this evil thing you're doing by profaning the Sabbath day?'" Now go down with me to verse 25. "So I contended with them and cursed them." Oh my goodness. "I struck some of them. I pulled out their hair." Try that one out. You know, we look at this business, and you see, what angered him wasn't that they were bothering him, it was what they were doing to the house of God. Now, you know, just okay, to put some of this in perspective a little bit. By the way, just as a contrast, just for a bit, go back with me to Ezra, the book before this, and look at, I mean, the same feeling, but look at what he ended up doing with it. Ezra chapter 9. Ezra chapter 9. Now let me begin with verse 1. "Now when these things had been completed, the priests approached me saying, 'The people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the people of the lands, according to their abomination.'" Not just, you know, we're becoming awful casual with this business of joining people up with the people of the land. Because, see, we're so loving. "According to their abominations, those are the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Jebusites and the Ammonites and the Moabites, the Egyptians and the Amorites." Now listen, "for they have taken some of their daughters as wives for themselves." See, they went and married unsaved women. "And for their sons, so that the holy race is intermingled with the peoples of the lands." You know what? We read this morning that God has set us apart to be a spiritual house and a holy priesthood. A holy priesthood does not defile itself. It just doesn't do this. But see, that sense of the holiness of God is far gone. But let's just watch this, okay? So he says they've done this. "They've intermingled this holy people with the peoples of the lands. And indeed, the hands of the princes and rulers have been foremost in this unfaithfulness." Now listen to this. "And when I heard about this matter, I tore my garment and my robe, and I pulled some of the hair from my head and my beard and sat down appalled." Now this is one thing. Nehemiah pulled some of their hair out. Ezra pulled his own hair out. I ask you a question, because you see, before we're going to get to chapter 4 and verse 26, we'll come back to it still next week. We're not going to make it this week, but listen to me carefully. When was the last time you thought of pulling your hair out because the holiness of God was being affected? Or when was the last time you even, felt some of this kind of anger at the defilement of the people of God and the church of God? You remember he says, we're back to 1 Corinthians 3, where he says, you know, you are the temple of God. And the temple of God is holy, which you are. See, we are the temple of God. It's a holy temple. Do we get bothered enough? I mean, were you talking about Ezra pulling out his beard and Nehemiah pulling out their hair and hitting some of them, see? Because he was bothered with the sense of the holiness of God being tarnished, as did Jesus when he picked up those pieces of rope, made them the rope, if you will, and then drove the money changers out of the temple. Does the holiness of God drive you to a truly zealous, godly, holy anger? I dare say that for many of us it does not. And I dare say that for some of us, and I put us in there, so I put myself in that category, somehow this bothers us a bit, and we can start saying, well, I can see how this could be pushed too far, and someone could take advantage of this, and all this kind of stuff. Or I heard of somebody doing this, and he justified because he said it was holy anger. When is the holiness of God and the defilement of that holiness, when did it last make you really angry, truly angry? I really do believe before going anywhere, see, that the issue is that there is a place for anger that is motivated by a true love for God and a true understanding of the holiness of God. It's interesting because, and I just, there are so many of these. Let me read this statement to you as a quotation. Although Nehemiah's particular action should not be considered as a pattern for us. This is, I'm reading a quotation, okay? It's just an assembly quotation. I do think, though, that, and you'd get sued if you tried anyhow. Although Nehemiah's particular action should not be considered a pattern for us, we should see in such cases action is necessary. And this is the quotation I would do fulfill it with. Complacency in the spiritual life can make one numb to the effects of sin. I'm just bothered that I don't get angry over a lot more than I get angry over. Let me just suggest some things just before we conclude. We should be angered with things that anger God. All one has to do is read the Old Testament prophets to see how angry God becomes when such things as injustice, immorality, and ungodliness are involved. I was reading through Ezra this last week again, just that statement about shepherds. God gets angry because the shepherds are not shepherding his people. And therefore you read in Zechariah 11, he says, I cut off all three shepherds in 1 month. I just did. It just got to the place I got angry because they were not caring for my people. And I cut them off and I determined I would become the shepherd in their place. When you think of this, you see injustices. You see, we should become angry and attempt to do something about injustices we see taking place today against people who have no way to fight back for themselves, whether it be at work or in our communities or wherever. We should become angry. Just read your Bible. Just read the Old Testament. I think, frankly, I am very conservative politically, no doubt. But I think that for some of us, we've not read the Bible enough. Now, I think also that the statement about the fact that the conservatives don't care about the needs of people, I don't think that's true. I think the fact that they don't seek to make a show of it, for example, when the Watts riots took place, before ever the liberals moved in to do anything, there were warehouses down there of paint and so forth that people were freely donating to help people fix their own houses up. I was involved down there before this ever happened and after it's happening, in teaching in a Bible school down there, because if you're going to solve the problem, and that's why I first started teaching, down in the center of Watts. And you see, the whole issue of life is you don't do it because it's a social agenda. On the other hand, you remember that passage in James? Pure religion undefiled is this. And there, by the way, there's no and in there. Visiting fatherless and widows in their affliction and keeping unspotted from the world. There's no and. It's just the two of them are inseparably connected. Care for widows, care for the fatherless, care for orphans and widows, and keeping oneself unspotted is totally inseparable. You can say, well, I keep myself pure. Are you caring for widows? I keep myself pure. Are you caring for those who are fatherless? Are we compassionate and caring? And we see the injustices. It should anger us to watch the injustices. It should. I watch things that happen to people. I've watched it, I can just name it, in Christian organizations where people have been hurt. And other people stand back. I've heard them talk about it and say, well, it's a terrible thing that they did to so-and-so, but I don't see them getting angry enough to do something, because, you see, if they do something, it may cost their own job, and they're not angry enough to go deal with the issue on somebody else's behalf because it may affect them somehow, see? The only problem is in the other side to it. From a very pragmatic point of view, not a biblical point of view, if in fact you don't act on behalf of somebody else, tomorrow it will be you that it happens to. That's not a good enough reason for reacting, but I tell you, it is a fact. The other thing is, do we get angry? Do you get angry over immorality? Do you really get angry over abortion? Do you really get angry? I mean, no. Just to say, well, this is a terrible thing. Do you really get angry? Do you get angry over pornography? Do you get angry over drugs? The story is told of a great English preacher. His name was F.W. Robertson, who wrote in one of his letters about the occasion when he met a man who was trying to lure a young girl into prostitution. He became so angry that he bit his lip until it bled. Do you become angry when you watch? See, where anger should come is you should never be angry because of what somebody does to you. That is never, 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 never right to do. I say that. I won't give you chapter and verse, but we'll talk about all bitterness and anger and clamor. But I will say to you that godly anger, biblically comes when the holiness of God is in some way affected by the lives of people who claim to be the children of God or by people who oppose the people of God. And godly anger also is seen by God himself and by those who truly know the heart of God when in fact injustice and immorality takes place. I set that as a background, and next week I want to come back to verse 31. I want to deal with where anger is wrong. And where anger is wrong is where it has all this kakia, this malice, when it comes from the feelings of the heart, and he says all. Now you can go back, if you can read in verse 31, and back to Ephesians again. We will come back and look at the direct verses next week. And just walk down through them, but with this as a background, because, and to tell you why I do that, but verse 31, let all bitterness and all wrath and all anger and all clamor and all slander be put away with you along with malice. I spend this time setting the background for these verses because I am so yoked to this world and so much a part of the life of the Gentiles. And I need to understand God so that I can understand in God's word elsewhere, so I can understand what God is saying here when God says, do be angry. Do be angry, and yet do not sin in your anger. There is a way to be angry and not to sin. That we will look at, and to deal with that, like I say, next week we'll go to verse 31 and start with that, where all bitterness and wrath and clamor and so forth is put away. And then we will come back and understand that we can be angry and yet not sin. I sat with someone last night who made a statement to me. He says, I did such and such, and it was out, I believe, of righteous indignation. I think that is very possible. I think it should be happening more often. And maybe better you pull out your hair than somebody else's hair, but anger should be there over things that affect the holiness of God and the care of his people.